Podcast 78, The Christian Connection with the Treaty of Waitangi. Today, rather than comment on the Gospel passage, I'm going to speak directly about the Treaty of Waitangi. Today is the day this year that we celebrate the signing of the founding document of our nation, the Treaty of Waitangi. I'd like to explore the Christian connection with the Treaty of Waitangi, because the involvement of Christian people with the treaty was quite considerable and is something that is never mentioned as part of our Waitangi Day events or narratives. I'd also like to reflect on what we can do to become genuinely bicultural citizens of Aotearoa New Zealand. In 2014, we celebrated the bicentenary of the coming of the gospel to New Zealand. It's now over 200 years that on Christmas Day, 1814, the Reverend Samuel Marsden came ashore at Rangihaua across the bay from Waitangi and preached the first Christian message in these islands. He spoke from today's reading, the Gospel of Luke, proclaiming glad tidings of great joy. Te Hari Nui. The Gospel message went on to have a major influence over Hmong Māori over the coming decades. It also played a critical role in the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. As we come to celebrate Waitangi Day, it is appropriate we reflect on how foundational Christianity was to the treaty. Without it, it is unlikely our nation's founding document would have been negotiated. The influence of Christianity in the story of our nation's birth was threefold. Firstly, it was the ethical and spiritual impulse behind the treaty proposal. The British had a poor track record of colonising with little regard for Indigenous people's rights. However, the influence of two key men in the Colonial Office in the 1830s saw our nation try to follow a different path. Lord Glenelg, Secretary for the Colonies, and Sir James Stephen, Permanent Under-Secretary, were both evangelical Christians. Their fathers had been MPs in Wilberforce's group that had ended the slave trade. Both also had connections to the Anglican Church Missionary Society, which had sent Reverend Samuel Marsden and other missionaries to New Zealand. Lord Glenelg and Sir James were committed to seeing Māori interests protected in the colonisation of New Zealand. In fact, quite radically, they initially opposed colonisation and wanted to see the formation of an independent Māori nation. However, they eventually realised colonisation was a tide they could not hold back. Instead, they opted to try to establish British law as a restraint on land-grabbing colonists. Their influence resulted in Lieutenant Governor Captain William Hobson being dispatched with instructions to seek Crown sovereignty on the basis of the free and intelligent consent of Māori, and to ensure their land and political rights were protected. James Stevens drafted the instructions which were given to William Hobson when he was sent to New Zealand in 1840, and these instructions included the following paragraph: "All dealings with the Aborigines for their lands must be conducted on the same principles of sincerity, justice, and good faith as must govern your transactions with them for the recognition of Her Majesty's sovereignty in the islands. Nor is this all. They must not be permitted to enter into any contracts in which they might be ignorant and unintentional authors of injuries to themselves. You will not, for example, purchase from them any territory, the retention of which by them would be essential or highly conducive to their own comfort, safety, or subsistence. The acquisition of land by the Crown for the future settlement of British subjects must be confined to such districts as the natives can alienate without distress or serious inconvenience to themselves. To secure the observance of these principles, will be one of the first duties of you as their official protector. When Captain Hobson arrived in New Zealand in January 1840, his momentous task was facilitated by the presence of both Anglican and Wesleyan missionaries. These pioneers of the Christian faith in New Zealand had already been working among Māori for about 25 years, and they provided a key element of facilitating the treaty process, not least of which because they could speak, read and write te reo Māori. CMS mission leader, the Reverend Henry Williams, was the key protagonist in this task. Despite having completed an arduous six-week journey from Otaki to Waitangi, when he arrived, Williams immediately set to work assisting Captain Hobson. Williams, with his son, translated the English draft of the treaty into Māori. He then played a leading role in explaining the treaty to the gathered chiefs as an interpreter at the proceedings. Without Reverend Williams' efforts and the support of his missionary colleagues, Captain Hobson would have struggled to make himself understood. Christianity's influence on the events at Waitangi also came via the Māori themselves. It's one thing for a treaty to be offered, but it also has to be agreed to. While there was vigorous debate among the chiefs, their eventual agreement was built upon the foundations of faith established among Māori over the previous 25 years. While the spread of Christianity in New Zealand had initially been slow, by the 1830s the gospel was surging through Māori population in New Zealand. Regular Māori attendance at Anglican services was recorded at more than 30,000 people on a Sunday, and the Wesleyans also experienced major growth of converts. As Michael King notes in his Penguin History of New Zealand, Te Atua, the God of the Bible, was on the move. When Captain Hobson arrived, Māori were positively predisposed to the offer he carried. They had already seen the benefits of Christianity, peace between the tribes, freedom for slaves, and stability that fostered prosperity. British law and government represented to them a further step towards a more prosperous society, and they also had a preference for British rule rather than French rule. As Claudia Orange notes, many chiefs also understood the treaty in terms of a biblical covenant. These factors, plus the implicit trust they had in the missionaries who were advocating the treaty, were key in securing their agreement to signing the treaty. Māori saw and still see the treaty with something of a spiritual lens, as well as a legal and diplomatic agreement. The te reo name for the treaty is Te Kawenata o Waitangi, the Covenant of Waitangi. What happened in the years that followed, sadly, is another story. Despite efforts by Reverend Williams and other missionaries like Octavius Hadfield and Thomas Grace, settler pressure for land prevailed. The treaty was dishonoured, and injustice, land confiscation and war followed. Efforts are now being made to try and right some of these historical wrongs, and the focus is turning to the future rather than the past. However, the seeds of the future are often found in the past. This Waitangi Day, let us remember the spiritual roots of our nationhood. Te Hari Nui, the gospel message, had a significant impact on the formation of the treaty. So what does this mean for us as Christians today? What things can we do to lean into this bicultural and heritage and country that we are part of, with its foundational treaty document? For Debbie and I, we sought out opportunities to learn te reo Māori for ourselves in a range of contexts, both through formal study and informal opportunities. We bought bilingual books for our children and grandchildren, and we read to them in both Māori and English. We sent our children in the late 1980s to Kohangareo and bilingual primary school, and that's in fact why we ended up in Forest Lake, because Forest Lake School had both Māori immersion, bilingual and English streams that the children could attend. We volunteer to help with Māori events that are part of our own contexts. For example, Kingitanga Day at the university. I volunteer for that. We loaded Te Aka, the Māori dictionary, onto our phones so we could look up Māori words we didn't know. We deliberately, intentionally engaged with Māori language and culture at every and any opportunity that came our way. So there are all sorts of things we can do to become more biculturally fluent citizens of this country. I co-teach a paper at the university about this for university staff, and most of the participants that have participated in this paper agree on several things as bottom lines that everyone living in Aotearoa New Zealand should engage with. Firstly, learn enough te reo so you can pronounce personal names and place names correctly and do things like simple greetings in Māori. Secondly, take any opportunities that are available to you to learn more about Māori culture and history. And in this parish, we've already done a parish pilgrimage with Bishop David that helped with this. Thirdly, research and learn about the land you currently live on in this area in terms of who the local people are, the key conflicts, what the history of the place is. For example, what the history of the Kingitanga is for Māori people in New Zealand. And we also include some regular things that we do at our morning services that reflect our bicultural nature in the Anglican Church. There is a small repertoire of Māori hymns that we sing, and we say the Lord's Prayer in English in Te Reo as part of our regular 8:30 services. All you have to do is look at the Anglican prayer book to see that we are a bicultural church, which also acknowledges our multicultural context in terms of the interwoven use of Te Reo Māori in the liturgy and forms the church uses. To sum up, we can firstly make an effort to engage with Māori culture and language in order for us to become biculturally aware people who live in Aotearoa New Zealand. In relation to the treaty settlement process, I believe the two major peoples of New Zealand have two different burdens. For Pākehā, descendants of the settler people, the burden is justice. Where the treaty covenant has been broken, as far as is possible, it must be put right. For Māori people, I believe the burden is forgiveness. There must be a giving up of continual and prolonged bitterness over the wrongs of the past, and a recognition that attempts are being made, and especially over the recent times, to begin to right these wrongs as far as that is possible. Aotearoa New Zealand is a multicultural nation with a bicultural foundation. For each of us, we must work out how we can engage with Māori language and culture, with our shared history, with our future together as a people, as a bicultural nation.